Okay, so today I would like to put a little bit more substance into the two pictures that I drew yesterday. If you remember, I drew some Feynman diagram for some quantum field theory. And some sort of a string Feynman diagram. I promise that in some sense, in the same sense as the scattering amplitude in the quantum field theory can be written as a sum over Feynman diagram, the string theory scattering amplitude will be written as a sum over pictures like this. But this is some two-dimensional surface embedded in space-time. Well, this is one-dimensional graph embedded in space-time. Now, the first part of the lecture, I want to really show you that the quantum field theory scattering amplitudes are indeed associated to graphs drawn in space-time, meaning that if you take some scalar field theory, the contribution to the scattering amplitude due to some graph can be really written in some moral or almost precise sense as an integral over all the maps from the graphs into space-time. With a weight which is roughly e to the minus m times the length of the graph. The total length of the graph. So we'll take this derivation as an inspiration of how to write the contribution of some surface to the string scattering amplitude. As an integral over all the maps from the surface to space-time. With an action which is just e to the minus the area of the surface. So these are our two objectives. So in a quantum field theory, in a scalar quantum field theory, how do you write the amplitude associated to a Feynman diagram? So you take some graph, you associate to each edge, you call E the set of edges of the graph. Then you associate to each edge some momentum that runs through that edge. Perhaps it's some convention that if you reverse the edge, you reverse the momentum. You attach to every edge a propagator. Can you read what I'm writing? I guess this is not an issue here. The time zone was a bit of an issue. So to each edge of my graph, I'm gonna put a associated propagator. To each vertex in my graph, I'll associate a momentum conservation. Something like that. And then I will integrate over all the internal momenta. Okay. I had to do something a bit careful with, for the external momenta. I mean, I'll have to add including these sums, some contributions on the external momenta, but let me just ignore that for now. It will not change almost anything what I'm saying. Okay, so this is more or less the expression you start with when you compute a Feynman diagram. I want to manipulate this expression a little bit. So I want to rewrite everything as some sort of a Gaussian integral. So I'm going to introduce some auxiliary variables, some LABs, and rewrite the propagator in a simple way. And I'm also going to rewrite the momentum conservation at the vertices in Fourier transform as an integral of the position of the vertices. Okay. So after we do that, I get something that looks like this. And then I can do the integral over the momenta because it's completely Gaussian. So what does it contribute to a specific momentum? There is this term, and then each momentum appears in two of these terms, one for each endpoint. Whatever signature, whatever signature in which this is okay. So what are we left with? So we still have the integral over the lengths. And the positions. And then I get the result of the Gaussian integral, which looks roughly like this. You should never trust any factors of two or four, or whatever you write. Roughly. Okay. So I have an integral over the position of the vertices, an integral over the sort of length, proper length of the or the size of the graph, and then this kernel associated to each edge of the graph. Now this kernel is actually just essentially the propagator of a free particle on two points in space time. LAB, sorry, it's a typo. So it's just LAB M squared. Now, the final observation, which I will demonstrate momentarily, is that this part can be written as a path integral over trajectories in space-time, which starts at xa and end at xb. With some very basic action, which in a moral sense can be taken to be just the proper length of the trajectory. Okay, I will, so this is in inverted commas. I will discuss this better in a moment. But so this is the intuitive picture that I want to have. So we rewrote the scattering amplitude as actually in this moral sense, we rewrote the scattering amplitude as just an integral over all possible ways you can embed this graph into spacetime. See, we chose a way to embed the vertices of the graph, and then we chose a path from the initial vertex to the final vertex for each edge. A moment. So now let me discuss a bit where the integral over L went. So the reason I put things in inverted commas is that, it's pretty tricky to make sense of a path integral which has an action like this. Okay, so I'm trying to do the path integral for some free particle with an action which is just the length of the trajectory. Okay, but it's pretty hard to make a path integral which involves a square root in the action. Also, we need to be pretty careful with this path integral because it has a gauge invariant. It has the action is invariant under some symmetry, some continuous symmetry, which is reparametrization. See, we wanted to describe a trajectory in space-time, and we decided to parameterize it in a certain way. We could have parameterized it in a different way. By just doing a change of variables from u to some other u prime. But this action is invariant over that. It's just the length of the path or the trajectory. Which means that if you try to do a path integral, you're gonna overcount very badly. So what you wanna try to do is this path integral in which you've divided away the volume of the diffeomorphisms. The variable u. So in order to somehow make sense of this, I need to replace this action with some action which is classically equivalent but I can quantize. Okay? And there is a standard trick to do that. Yes, that's right. So there is a canonic, there is a standard way to do that, which is to consider a slightly different action, which looks like that. So classically, I can just write down the equations of motion for E. So extremize this action with respect to E, and I will go back to that. But this is quadratic in the time derivative, so it's much easier to work with. So I can try to define path integral like this. Oh, maybe minus. Now you could complain that okay, the path integral looks good in the x variables, but I'm still doing a path integral over E, which appears with an inverse here. So not so good. But it turns out that we can use this parametrization invariance to actually gauge fixed E. And then we're left with something we can deal with. So how does the form of this invariant, reparametrization invariant, show up in this action? Well, by inspection, this action is going to work out if you transform E in such a way that E prime du prime equals to E du. So E kind of transforms like a one form. Actually, for future purposes, it's better to think about E square, the U square, as a metric on your line. So we traded this action with an unpleasant square root for an action which is quadratic but has an extra auxiliary metric on your time trajectory, on your world line. So we have one degree of freedom in the diffeomorphisms, one degree of freedom in E. We can try to cancel against each other. Now we cannot get rid of E completely because this tells you that the integral from 0 to 1 of E du is gauge invariant. You can think about this as the intrinsic length of this world line. So we can leave L and throw away everything else. We can take E to be, we can gauge fix E by just saying that E equal L. Okay? And then this starts looking like what we had written up there. Indeed, if you literally do the path integral, so now we got rid of this, we are left with the dl, an integral over L outside, which is the zero mode. I'm doing a gauge fixing by hand. If I were honest, I should do things more carefully, make sure that these two measures really cancel out, put some ghosts and all of that. I'm not gonna do it today. Okay, so you see that now we have an integral over L, and then we have this Gaussian integral over X, which is very easy to do, and ends up producing this sort of expression with integrals over L. So I'm sorry, I was really supposed to leave the integral over L here, and then write some equality in which there is no integral over L. Okay, so of course, this seems to be, I mean, if just done for particles, this is a pretty pointless exercise. It just gives a nice intuitive meaning to the Feynman diagram, which is nice to have. But now I'm gonna repeat the same steps for the strings. Now, this was just for a scalar field theory. You could do a similar word line formalism for other quantum field theories. You just need to add a little extra structure. So here we just had a quantum mechanics on the word line whose degrees of freedom were just the position in space-time. If you add extra degrees of freedom on the word line, you end up with richer structures on the word line. So you end up with particles which carry extra quantum numbers. They might be spinors, vectors, and so on. And again, this is something we will do when we start talking about superstring theory. Okay, now let's try to repeat the same exercise for the strings. So I want to make sense of an integral, which is the two-dimensional generalization of this. Okay? I have some surface in space-time. I can compute the area induced by the space-time metric. I leave finding this formula as an exercise, but so the area of a surface in space-time is the integral of the square root of the determinant of a 2x2 matrix, which is the induced matrix. So what have I done? I'm describing this surface in space-time in terms of some map from the surface to space-time. I pick some parametrization on the surface, at least locally, with some coordinates u1 and u2. But I'm writing an action which is invariant under reparametrizations. So if you do a change of coordinate, the induced metric gets transformed by a factor of the Jacobian acting on both this index and this index. You take the determinant, you pull out the determinant of the Jacobian, which cancels out against the transformation of the measure. So this is a reparametrization invariant quantity, and it's the area of the surface. I'm going to put some tension in front. And then I need to do a path integral over all possible such surfaces. Again, presumably dividing by different morphisms. Otherwise, I'll overcount degrees of freedom. I want to make a path integral over all possible surfaces, not over all possible way to describe a surface. Now, again, this is an ugly action because it's square root. It has a square root. It's called the Nambu-Goto action. And we're going to trade it for a classically equivalent action, which we know how to quantize. So now I'm going to write down another action. Now it's called the Polyakov action. Which is just the generalization of this expression. Except if we're going to use an auxiliary metric on the surface. Okay, so let's stare at this expression for a bit. So I introduced a new degree of freedom, a metric, on the surface. H is just the determinant of the metric. H is upper indices, it's just the inverse of the metric. Okay? So the same notations that you would have in general relativity. Sorry, I meant take U1, the U2. Because the metric transforms under diffeomorphisms in the usual way. Okay. And that means that when you contract it to the partial derivatives, you get something that is invariant under reparameterizations. The square root of h transforms in a way that compensates for the transformation of the measure. All of this is something you've already seen in general relativity, I'm sure. Did you do some general relativity, I guess? Yes, okay.
Can I just ask maybe sort of thing, wait, did you rewrite the integration variables to du1, du2 as opposed to dua, dub here in the last line?
Well, because I already had A and B, and I didn't want to give an impression it was some sort of strange contraction. Also, when you write a measure, you just... So, again, I'm leaving as an exercise the fact that this measure is equivalent classically to this measure. I think you might have already solved the exercise yesterday. And it's relatively straightforward. You might need some to remember how to vary the inverse of a metric or the determinant of a metric with respect to the metric. But again, they're the same manipulations you might do to find the Einstein equations out of the Einstein-Hilbert action. So, okay, can we make sense of this path integral? Actually, before that, is there any question? Yes.
You took one action and then at the quantum level substituted by the next plus a equivalent action.
That's right.
That's not exactly equal, is it?
That's true. So I just don't know how to make sense of this. I know how to make sense of this, and it gives the right answer. So I feel okay with it.
My understanding was that even if, I mean, since you go from that action to that action, mm-hmm. we have a particular value of E that we get from solving the constraint that we get from varying the polygon action. And we use that to gauge fix the second path integral.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it would explicitly be the same.
Yeah, I was wondering if it's possible to just do a gauge fixing to go back to this action. I was getting a bit confused yesterday. You might be right. I was wondering that if I try to set E equal to x dot squared, that's not a gauge fix, square root of x dot squared, not a gauge fixing, because.
But shouldn't we first solve for E, I mean, find the equation for E from varying polygon action? That would give us a constraint. And then we impose a gauge fixing after imposing the constraint.
Well, I honestly don't remember. So it might be the case that if you do the gauge fixing properly, you can just go back to this, meaning that if the gauge fixed version of this and the gauge fixed version of this action would be actually the same. I was trying to check it yesterday, and I couldn't quite get it right. I mean, if you just do naively the path integral over E, it's not quite sure that you get this. But I think you're correct that if you did a different kind of gauge fixing here, something like a light cone gauge, where you set x plus dot equal to 1, you might be able to rewrite this as something sensible, which still agrees with that. I think that's true. Would be a good exercise. So now at this point, if you want to proceed in analogy to with a free particle, we can get a bit in. There is something unpleasant going on. The metric has 3 degrees of freedom. Different morphisms have 2 degrees of freedom. So there is no way we're going to be able to eliminate the metric just using the different morphisms alone. And if you're trying to do this story for more than 2 dimensions, like for a membrane moving in space-time, here is where more or less we go get stuck. For a string, though, something surprising comes to the rescue, which is that this action has an extra symmetry besides the diffeomorphisms. There's a new symmetry called Weyl symmetry, which sends H, which just rescales the metric by a position dependent amount. It's a very weird symmetry. It's telling you that essentially you can take your metric, you can take your action on a flat plane on the table, or the action on a table with a bump, and the results will be the same. this is a transformation that preserves angles but changes lengths completely. Very strange symmetry. But still, it's a symmetry of this action. It's pretty simple to see. The inverse metric transforms with e to the minus phi. The determinant of the metric transforms with e to the phi squared. Take the square root, and it cancels out. This is absolutely crucial for everything to be able to keep going, because it means that you might worry at this point that you're actually badly overcounting in your path integral. If this is truly a symmetry of the problem, why don't you just divide by Weyl? If I divide by Weyl, now I have 3 degrees of freedom that I can use to hopefully gauge fix the metric to something simple, and then just deal with this Gaussian integral in X. Now, there is a bit of a hitch, which is that even if the classical action is invariant of Weyl transformations, the measure might not be. It's possible to have something that's called an anomaly. So anomalies are a pretty rich subject, and I believe you haven't encountered them before. So I'll try to discuss them carefully at the end of the lecture. For now, I would like just to say that this measure is typically not invariant in the Weyl transformations, but in some cases it is. So if the measure is invariant in the Weyl transformation, you can just divide by Weyl transformations and keep going. And this is what it's called the critical string theory. If the measure is not invariant in the Weyl transformations, then you get something called the non-critical string theory, which is ultimately going to be equivalent to a critical string theory, but it requires just an extra step of thinking. So let me just assume for now that the measure is invariant in the Weyl transformations. So it turns out that the failure, when something is not invariant under a symmetry, you can always try to correct it to be invariant. But sometimes there are obstructions to this correction. These obstructions are rather topological in nature. So there is a finite set of, very often there is a finite set of obstructions that need to be eliminated before you can correct the measure into something that, that works. In the case of wild transformations, there is just one obstruction, one number that tells you if things are working or not working. And each piece of your measure contributes to this number. Each of the x coordinates contributes one, say. An integral over the measure of the metric contributes minus 26. So that means that if you want to have wild invariance, you need to have 26 coordinates in your space, in your space-time. So bosonic strings are most naturally defined in 26 dimensions. Sorry? So, I didn't tell you where the minus 26 come from. So, just the fact that if you look, if you compute the obstruction to correcting these into something wild invariant, the obstruction is 1 for each of the x coordinates. And if you compute it for this, you get minus 26. So we need to have 26 of these guys to make up for this. Okay? So if you have 26 coordinates, you have a critical string theory. You can divide by wild transformations, and you can keep going. So let me just do that for now. So the next step should be to gauge fit the metric. Use the diffeomorphisms invariance and wild transformations to make the metric into something simple enough that I can almost forget about it. Now remember, here we couldn't forget about the metric completely. There was a little bit of gauge invariant information. So now you should ask, what's the gauge invariant information in a metric, modulo diffeomorphisms, and modulo wild transformations? Now that's not an easy question. And I'm gonna give you the answer, I'm not gonna prove the answer to you. So the answer is that what's left is something called a complex structure. I'll try at least to sketch to you what a complex structure is and why does it appear in this problem. So now there is a nice theorem of differential geometry that if you're given some metric in two dimensions, you can always locally write it in this form. So you can always make it diagonal, proportional to the identity up to some scale factor, modulo diffeomorphisms. So you can always find a set of a coordinate system in which this is true. Which is, means locally, you can always find a coordinate system and then a wild transformation that makes the metric flat. Now you might not be able to do this globally. Okay, so you'll have your surface and you'll have patches. In each patch, you'll have some coordinate system where your metric looks like that. In another patch, you have a metric in a different coordinate system and it with a different scale factor. And in between, you have some coordinate transformation and some wild rescaling. Now, there is another beautiful theorem that tells you that once you have this picture, you can always pick your coordinate systems and your coordinate transformations in a rather special way. They can be holomorphic coordinate transformations. Now, if you want to try to understand this as an exercise, you need to ask yourself, what are the coordinate transformations which map a flat metric to a metric of this form. These are called infinitesimal coordinate transformations. These are called conformal Killing vectors. And if you try to look for conformal Killing vectors in two dimensions, you'll find that they are holomorphic coordinate transformations. What does it mean? means that I'm gonna, you can combine your coordinates into a complex coordinate, write your metric in terms of the complex coordinate in this form. Now you see that once it's written in this form, if you do an holomorphic change of coordinate, so if you rewrite z as some z prime, some functional z prime, the z just becomes the z prime times the one-dimensional Jacobian. The z bar becomes the z bar prime. And so you see that your metric remains conformally flat, remains flat up to a wild transformation. So your e to the phi prime, just e to the phi times the z over the z prime squared. So this shows you at least that coordinate, if you take your coordinate transformations to be holomorphic, then the structure can hold. It takes a little bit more effort to show that you can always do so if you're given a metric on some Riemann surface. You can always find a set of holomorphic coordinate systems which are related by holomorphic coordinate transformations. So if you're given a manifold and an atlas of complex coordinates with holomorphic coordinate transformations, that's what is a complex structure. So a complex structure is just something that allows you to talk about complex coordinates in a consistent way over the Riemann surface, over the surface. And depending on the topology of the surface, the space of possible complex structures might be more or less complicated. If I give you a sphere, then there is only one complex structure. I don't think there is time today to discuss this in sufficient detail. But if I give you a donut, then there is a one-dimensional space of complex structure. If I give you a pretzel, there is a six-dimensional space, I think, of possible complex structures, and so on and so forth.
One complex dimensional or
six complex dimensional. So that means that we can rewrite our integral over metric modulo diffeomorphisms and while as a finite dimensional integral on some moduli space of complex structures. It generalizes this integral over the length that you had in one dimension. Locally, my metric can always be made flat. So locally, the path integral over the remaining coordinates that now has a very simple action. I can always write the action with this being the flat metric. So So we got to a point where we can definitely keep going. Meaning we reduced this very difficult looking problem to a purely Gaussian path integral, the path integral of a free field theory, so the free two-dimensional scalar theory on my surface, followed by an integral of all possible shapes, complex structures of this surface. As you can imagine, this is easy. This is a bit harder, but doable, at least kind of doable. Okay, any questions before we perhaps discuss anomalies a little bit more?
Could you define again what you mean by complex structure?
Mm-hmm. A complex structure is just a prescription to cover your manifold with a complex coordinate.
So you cover it in complex charts?
Yes, with complex, with holomorphic coordinate transformations. That's all. Now, let me see if I can give an example of a complex structure. Well, if you have a torus, for example, you can define a torus by starting with a plane and mm-hmm. identifying periodically two directions. So in complex coordinates, you can say, okay, I want to identify the point labeled by z with a point labeled by z plus one. And the point z with the point z plus tau, where tau is some complex number. Okay. And it turns out that tau parameterizes the complex structures. So there is no way to map the coordinate z to some other coordinate which satisfies this sort of periodicity with different value of tau. Okay, so yeah, anomalies. so I don't want to give a general discussion of what anomalies are or not, but I just want to explain why do you encounter troubles with trying to define a measure which is value invariant. So how do you define a path integral measure? Typically, you want to throw away some short distance physics. You want to take your field, like the axis, expand it in modes, like Fourier modes, put a cutoff, throw away all the modes which fluctuate too wildly, define your path integral with the cutoff, and then carefully send the cutoff to infinity. Now, so the first question I can ask you, okay, suppose I have a path integral over a on a field defined on a manifold, okay, instead of the flat space. So you cannot just do Fourier transform. How do you regularize the path integral? Can you do it in a way that, for example, is diffeomorphism invariant? Suppose I give you a manifold with a metric. Can we define a path integral in a way that is invariant under changes of coordinates? Well, you would like to pick a regularization which doesn't mention coordinates at all. That would be ideal. Well, if you have a metric, you can define something like the Laplace operator. You can look for eigenfunctions of the Laplace operator and expand in eigenfunctions and throw away all eigenfunctions which have eigenvalue bigger than some cutoff. This doesn't really mention coordinate systems and gives you a regularization which is quite clearly diffeomorphism invariant. Now, what goes wrong with that if you try to do wild transformation? Well, how does the Laplacian look like? Something like this, right? Well, unfortunately, this is not wild invariant. If you do wild rescaling, the things inside, I think, behaves pretty well, but then on the outside, you get the rescaling. So if you try to write an equation like this, if you do a wild transformation, you get a different equation, a different set of modes. I mean, intuitively, a wild transformation can make a patch of space much bigger or much smaller. So it's very hard to give an intrinsic meaning to how fast something is fluctuating. And there are just, you can look for alternatives to the Laplacian, but it's just very hard to find a prescription which allows you to throw away consistently a set of modes in a way that does not depend on your choice of wild frame. So this is why there is a problem. You can encounter a problem with wild symmetry that is just not possible to find a cutoff prescription which is wild invariant. Now, there are some caveats. I'm assuming diffeomorphism, that you also want to keep diffeomorphism invariant, and you also want to keep some other symmetries. For example, you want to treat the excess all the same way, Lorentz invariant. There are ways to do trade-offs. For example, there are some, if you do what's called the light cone quantization, when you gauge fix diffeomorphisms by sacrificing two of your coordinates, just setting things like, you know, by saying that I use the two coordinates to parameterize the surface itself, roughly. Well, then you don't encounter problems with wild invariance, but later on in the calculation, you find out that unless you have 26 dimensions, Lorentz invariance is lost. So, you know, when you have anomalies, there is always a certain freedom in pushing things around. There is a problem. There is a topological intrinsic problem. You can push it all over the place by doing different choices. The problem never goes away. It's a bit tricky to compute by hand the transformation of this measure under wild transformations. We're gonna use a slightly different way, a slightly more indirect way to look at this problem in the next lectures. So in a quantum field theory, you can express invariance under you can express this sort of invariance in terms of properties of the stress tensor. So at some point, we're going to study the stress tensor, trying to define it in the quantum theory, and seeing that some of the properties that we expect to see are not there, unless we have 26 dimensions. Okay, any questions? We have a bit of time, so feel free to.
You said that there's an obstruction that you can compute to correcting the measure to be make it longer.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Is there some like natural place that this obstruction lives?
I believe so. I can't quite remember what is the precise mathematical place, but I can describe it in words. So we're given some measure. Of your fields, okay? And we're given some transformation of the fields under your symmetry. So we apply this transformation, and if there is some problem, right, it means that the measure will not go back to itself. I'll have some extra piece in my transformation. Now I want to try to find a way to cancel this. So I can try to replace my measure with a new measure. Okay. Well, this is something that is not invariant, but whose transformations cancel this transformation, this extra piece. So I can try to look for some big F such that F of phi g minus F of phi is little f. Okay. So this is where the obstruction live, in a sense. So these F themselves must satisfy some property. For example, if I do a sequence of true transformations, I'll find relations like F of phi of gg prime must be equal to F of fg prime of phi plus F g of phi g prime, something like that. So we have a space of functionals with a constraint and defined up to shifts by these sort of differences. So I start looking like a cohomology problem, right? There is space of f's, there is some differential which has of f that has to be zero. And f is defined up to exact things. So the space of obstructions lives in the quotient, lives in the space of solutions of this problem, modulo things that can be written in this form. Any more questions?
We started only with diffeomorphism symmetry, and then we realized there was another one, the mm-hmm. biosymmetry.
Yes.
How do we know there isn't another symmetry hidden somewhere?
Well, you don't, but if the final answer is well defined, then probably there wasn't, because if there had been, you would have gotten infinity. Mm-hmm. Okay, is that a bit of a glib answer, but roughly. You do these things because they work. If they didn't work, I wouldn't be. Actually, I forgot to discuss non-critical strings. Maybe I can use just a couple minutes. So what's going to happen if your measure is not well invariant? Okay. Then you have your path integral. You do a wild transformation to it, and it transforms. Transforms in a, and it's always possible to. So Polyakov computed the form of the F, which cannot be cancelled by a big F. It's something called the Polyakov action. I think I've wrote it down here. But again, don't trust my science. It's written down in the textbooks. I did not write it down, of course. So it almost looks like a free action, although I think that the sign is peculiar. So in front of here, there is something like dimension minus 26, okay, plus minus, I don't remember. Then there is, I believe, a funny potential, something like that. And there must also be some coupling to the metric, I think, with some important number in front. I'm sorry, I thought I'd written it down, but I must have printed the wrong version of the file. So what does this mean? It means that if you cage fix the metric, besides these integrals, you're going to find an extra integral over this wild factor. And here you'll have an extra action from the wild factor. So the final result is not very different from the critical string theory. It's just that besides the x fields to describe the usual coordinates, there is a new coordinate, a funny coordinate with some unpleasant extra potential and some unpleasant features. But so you find a modification of the critical string theory. This extra coordinate, because of these funny features, ends up contributing the correct amount to the anomaly to make up for the missing dimensions. Now, non-critical string theories have their own problems. If you try to have less than 26 dimensions, you can make them work more or less only for less than one dimension or less than one. It's possible to go higher than 26 dimensions. There's something called supercritical strings. Again, they have some troubles. I'm not aware of a fully well-defined supercritical string theory, but they exist in some partial way. But they can be treated fully inside the formalism of critical string theory. They don't require extra stuff. They just move in some funny space-time.
What are the critical problems?
Might have tachyons, typically. That's typically what kills them. They don't have supersymmetry, which brings other problems.